Trail and Ultra Runners, what is going on? What's happening? Welcome to a really special episode of the CoopCast, the first in a series of special episodes of the CoopCast that is all about anti-doping measures that we can take in the sport of trail and ultra running. This has been in the works for a really long time, over a year, in fact. In fact, this first conversation that I had with Dr. Fedoric over at USADA was scheduled in March of 2020, right before the pandemic hit. In fact, the day that their offices closed was the day that I was supposed to go in for this particular interview. And it has been over a year in the making. And I'm actually very fortunate that it took over a year because I was able to gather some of these other interviews that I always wanted to do and really compile them into a series. And so I'm really excited. Over the course of the next 5 weeks, I'll be releasing five different podcasts, all from different people's perspectives, who are influencers, policymakers, athletes, people who have run it, who have had encounters within the current anti-doping systems that exist around the world, all to gather their individual perspectives and use those perspectives and use that knowledge and expertise for the solutions that we can potentially create in trail and ultra running. Make no mistake, you guys have heard me say this before. I've been tooting this horn for over a year now. Trail and ultra running is on a parabolic rise. We are going to continue to see more athletes come into the sport. We're going to see better athletes come into the sport. We're going to see more professionalism come into the sport. We're going to see more money come into the sport. And that is going to continue. We keep looking at the rise of ultra runners over the last 4 years, and there is no indication that that is stopping. And I wholeheartedly believe that from a professionalism and from an anti-doping standpoint, we are truly at an inflection point where there is not a culture of doping within the sport, but that is not static. And we can choose to do something now for the betterment of the athletes and the entire ecosystem in the future, or we can sit on our hands and wait another decade. And when that decade goes by, we're going to look back and we're going to kick ourselves because the sport has kind of gone awry, just like many of the other endurance sports that we've seen, and even sports like weightlifting and other Olympic sports where they got caught behind the eight ball. In fact, I have a podcast coming up in a couple of weeks talking about those exact scenarios, so you will have to stay tuned. So here's what is on tap for the next 5 weeks. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Fedoric, who's the chief science officer over at USADA. Next week, released on June 3rd, I will be talking with Paul Demio, who is the author of The Anti-Doping Crisis in Sport, Causes, Consequences, Solutions, which is a fantastic book. You guys go ahead and check that out in advance of the podcast. It'd actually be really insightful. On June 10th, I have a conversation with Lisa Roberts, who's a former professional triathlete and got entangled in Western States' anti-doping policy. And we talk a lot about the consequences of that. On June 17th, I have one of the few people who have actually put some effort into this in the trail and ultra running community, and that is Charlie Ware. And we talk about what he has done to date and how we can move forward. And then finally, on June 24th, I have a conversation with two of the people that I respect the most in the sport, and that's one of my athletes, Dylan Bowman, and fellow coach Mario Fraioli. And we discuss, we basically have a brainstorming session on what anti-doping solutions can look like and how we can best serve the community. What I want to have happen at the end of all of these podcasts is for them to serve as an initial educational galvanizing piece for the community to come together and ultimately create solutions. And those solutions are not easy. Don't get me wrong. We are not going to be able to copy and paste something from the IOC, copy and paste something from WADA. We're not going to be able to easily come up with a contract boilerplate draft of something and have everybody sign it. They are going to be hard, and these solutions are going to be full of compromises. They are going to be imperfect, but hopefully practical and pragmatic. And it's going to take a lot of elbow grease, which fortunately, ultra runners are really renowned for their level of effort that they can put into things. It's going to take a lot of elbow grease to put together. So I hope after listening to all of these the community can come together as a whole to try to create some reasonable solutions. The best way to get all these podcasts is just go and subscribe. For the life of me, whenever I throw something up on Apple Podcasts, the subscribers get it immediately, and the people who don't subscribe, they get it like, I don't know, sometimes an hour later, sometimes a day later. So if you don't want to be caught out in the cold with the conversation, go ahead and subscribe. You'll get it immediately on any of your podcasting platforms, starting with this one with Dr. Fedoric. Before I get into that conversation, though, and before any of this can actually take off, I do have to go over some efforts of full disclosure. And that is because anytime I have ever remotely walked anywhere close to talking about doping or anti-doping solutions, inevitably the Twidiots come out of the woodworks and start throwing stones and hurling arrows. Do you hurl an arrow or shoot it? Anyway, I'm subject to a lot of criticism. And that's fine. I've gotten used to it over the years. It's been something that I've been dealing with for 20 some odd years, and I'm okay with it. I'm comfortable with where I'm at right now. But if I'm being honest, that criticism and that polarization has really kept me on the sidelines of this conversation and of this topic. And I'm not afraid anymore. I'm not afraid of the criticism. I've got thick skin. If people want to come after me with whatever, I'm cool with that. But I want to go over these efforts of full disclosure kind of for the uninformed, the people that are just getting into this and have no awareness of it. Because I don't want any of the nonsense that is inevitably going to ensue after I release these podcasts. I don't want any of that nonsense to stand in the way of the information and to stand in the way of the effort. Because I'm not going out here on a limb for nothing. I'm going out here on a limb because I want to leave the sport better than I found it. And I do believe that we are well served as a community to come up with solutions now before the problems actually start to arise. So this whole controversy has to do with my very non-relationship with Lance Armstrong and my very good relationship with his former coach and my boss and somebody who got me into coaching, Chris Carmichael. I'm going to take you through that whole storyline, just like I have with my family members, just like I have with my athletes, just like I have with my fellow coaching colleagues, just like I've had with anybody in the community who bothers to ask and wants to sit down for 10 minutes and discuss it. I'm going to take you through the whole thing. If you're rolling your eyes right now and you've heard me say this or you just don't care, feel free to fast forward 10 minutes. I'm not going to hold that against you. But I have to say something because it's weird if I don't. I'm not going to ignore this, and I'm not going to ignore that people are going to come out of the woodworks and say whatever, because it would just be weird, and ultimately it would stand in the way of us coming together to find a solution. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm off the sidelines with this. I'm getting up off the bench and put me in coach. And part of me doing that is kind of releasing to the world this non-issue, as weird as that actually sounds. And so here it is. My coaching career began in 2000. Super humbly, that's why I begin these podcasts with I am your humble host, super humbly as a very lowly intern with a company called CTS. Now, how I found CTS was very serendipitous. I knew I wanted to be an endurance coach. There are really only two avenues I had to go down. The first avenue was within the collegiate coaching ranks and cross country and track. And with all due respect to those fine individuals, that's a coaching carousel. And I did not want to play ball in that arena. The second opportunity I had was an internship over at the Olympic Training Center. And for a variety of reasons, I just didn't want to take advantage of that opportunity. So as I was trying to figure out how to get involved in coaching, in the year 2000, I just happened to stumble upon an internship, and stumble upon is very literal in every sense of the word, an internship called CTS, whose founder, its CEO, and current CEO, Chris Carmichael, was Lance's coach during his Tour de France run, and even when he was going back to a junior. Now, me being an endurance aficionado, and also a native Texan, that's absolutely a part of it, And Lance's prominence, not only in sport, but as an iconic world figure, had an absolute impact in my attraction to come on board with CTS in the year 2000 as a very lowly, I can't remember if I was unpaid. I might have got paid like $500 a month. I wasn't paid much. Intern that was sweeping the floors and packaging together soft goods and maybe coaching a little bit on the side. That aura of getting involved in elite sport on that level was absolutely attracted me. So I took the internship kind of on that and that alone. What became very clear to me within months, a few very short months of joining that organization, is that it was far bigger than the relationship between one coach and one athlete. I literally had at my disposal coaches that had worked with Ironman world champions, with Olympic medalists, world championship medalists, athletes and coaches across all four of the major sports, football, baseball, basketball, and hockey, coaches that worked with the motorsports athletes, such as IndyCar drivers, Formula One drivers, and NASCAR champions, you name it. We had a coaching staff and a coaching stable that at the time was unparalleled. And here I was, this 21-year-old knucklehead that couldn't coach his way out of a wet paper bag. I got to take it all in, and I was like a kid in a candy store. And very quickly, what started out as me starting with this company simply for the reason that Lance Armstrong was somehow involved in it, to I really enjoy what I'm doing, and this is the opportunity of a lifetime, because all of these opportunities are directly in front of me, to which I had no idea what I was stepping into. That became very apparent from the get-go. And so I stuck with it. I went from an intern who couldn't coach to a coach that could coach a little bit better, and then a coach that was okay, and then a coach that was pretty good, and then a coach that was better than pretty good, and then all of a sudden to the coaching director, which I had oversight and management responsibilities over the entire coaching staff. And then I started to get involved in the operations of the company as a whole, and now I manage the suite of ultramarathon coaches that we have here at CTS. And that storyline is important because it runs a similar path as Lance's career, where I came on board and he was winning or riding or whatever we're calling it right now, his second or third Tour de France, and then he won his fourth, and then his fifth, and then his sixth, and then his seventh, and then his comeback, and then the entire fall from grace that we all publicly witnessed, I got to ride alongside with that on the sidelines. And during the course of that journey, and even during Lance's rise from first Tour de France win to seventh Tour de France win, or whatever we're calling them, people would ask me, hey, do you think Lance is doping? And those whispers got louder and louder and louder. And every single time, no matter who asked me what or what format it was asked of me in, whether it was family member, friend, training partner, coaching colleague, whatever, I said the exact same thing every single time because it's the truth. And that's, I don't know shit. I have only met Lance a small handful of times for very brief handshakes. There is zero chance he would ever be able to pick me out at a bar or a restaurant or at a social event. I simply have had no relationship with him, nor have I ever had any sort of relationship with him, nor did I really even care if he was doping or if he wasn't. And I know that that sounds weird. I know that from the outside looking in, for somebody who came into a company partially because of this relationship between Chris and Lance, for me to say, well, it doesn't care. I know that seems kind of a flippant attitude, but the fact of the matter is it's the honest truth. I was more involved in coaching athletes and growing coaches and taking advantage of all of the other opportunities where I did have great relationships with And a lot of those individuals I've brought onto this podcast, such as JT Kearney, you guys should go and check that out, who's singularly had probably the biggest impact in my entire coaching career. But I was more involved in those happenings with those athletes, with those coaches, with those individuals. And I could care less about the Lance Armstrong storyline at the time. We can all look back now, and now that the curtain has been peeled back, at all of the mistakes that cycling as a whole has made over the course of that time, and really continues to make now, if we're being honest, and we're going to talk about that on a future podcast as well. And those mistakes are tragic. And almost all of those individuals have owned up to those mistakes. And we can learn. We as the ultra running community can learn a lot from those mistakes. But I simply wasn't involved in any way, shape, or form. And not only was I not involved, I wasn't even close. I've never been a subject or a person of interest for any of these dealings having to do with Lance Armstrong or the Reason decision or any of the aftermath of that from USADA or WADA or any of those interested parties. The great thing about this, though, is that you don't have to take my word for it. And we've all heard dopers and people that have been involved in doping deny, deny, deny over the years. And it's very unfortunately become cliche that it's deny first and deny until the death. And I know that this dialogue might actually sound like that. But the great thing is you don't have to take my word for it. One of the fantastic things that USADA did with the Reason decision, which is kind of the whole demise of Lance Armstrong as we know it today, is they've made all those records public. They made all the testimony public. They made all the affidavits public. They made the rationale public. And you can go and find it right now. You can go right now, search for it, easily find it. You can control F. Coop, K-O-O-P, on any or all of those documents, and there's several hundred of them to pour through, and I'm not anywhere mentioned there. I quite simply was never or have ever been involved in any of those in any way, shape, or form. Now, there are going to be some people out there when these podcasts that come out that are going to insinuate that I was involved, that somehow I knew something. I must have known something because I worked for CTS and I worked for Chris, and this whole thing is a huge scandal, and everything dealing with Lance or within 1,000 miles of Lance must be dirty. Just go look it up, people. I'll put all the links up to that on the website or on the show notes to this. Go look it up. Go find it. Go do your own research. You don't have to take my word for it. You can take other people's word for it. There are going to be other people that just simply say bad things. I have a character flaw. I have bad judgment. I should have done this. I should have done that. Those opinions are fine. I'm cool with that. You guys want to have your own opinion about stuff? Great. Everybody's allowed to have an opinion. But you're not allowed to your own facts. And so, if you come out with facts that are incorrect, or you are somehow misstating my lack of involvement within this whole thing, make no mistake that I will correct the record, and that I will correct the record with the actual facts. You want to come out, you want to come at me with your opinions. You don't like my hair. You don't like the way I run. You think I'm stupid, whatever. I don't care. You can say it. Great. That's your opinion. You're entitled to it, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And that will happen when this comes out, and that will be unfortunate. But I hope that we can see through all of that for the nonsense that it actually is. And I really hope that none of that clutters the information that is to come for this podcast and the next several podcasts. The final thing that I will say is that I have never turned down any interview, any conversation, any form of dialogue ever about any of this. I have always been transparent, and I've always been an open book to the obnoxious nature of this 20-minute intro. And that is going to remain the same. If anybody wants to contact me at any point about anything, about any form, in any format, I am game. All of my information is public. You guys know how to get a hold of me. I've never shied away from any of that because I, quite frankly, have absolutely zero to hide. My record is beyond reproach when it has to do with this. So, with that as an intro, I hope everybody can buckle down for the next 5 podcasts. And in advance, I thank all the guests for coming on because some of these topics are not the easiest to talk about. And we'll get into that in a few weeks, or in this podcast, but also over the course of the next few weeks. So thank you to Dr. Fedoric. Thank you to Paul Dimio. Thank you to Lisa Roberts. Thank you to Charlie Ware. And thank you to Dylan and Mario for recording these with me. I realize that that some of these conversations are just hard, you know, but they're necessary. So we're going to get right into it with the first podcast of 5. And this is with Dr. Matt Fedoric, who's the chief science officer over at USADA. Let's get right into it. I want to know first off, before we get into anything, because this is a super interesting curiosity point for me, having a biochemistry background, is how have the dried blood spot tests been going? I know that's been a really big project, and COVID kind of like accelerated it to a thousand miles an hour. So I'm kind of curious as to how that's going.
Yeah, I mean, it's going fantastic. We started in 2017, and you know, we are culminating now actually in just about rolling out a official technical document, which allows us to start officially under WADA code compliant rules, collecting and analyzing dried blood spots. So where it's been a pilot project up to date, it's really, we've tried to advance the science and advance our experience so that globally, this is hopefully going to be a brand new matrix that can be used, you know, in every country if they have the resources and they want to do the blood testing.
We're going to back up just a little bit because the listeners aren't even going to be familiar with it, but it's a test. You literally take a pinprick of blood.
Yeah.
You put it on what looks like a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And that gets tested.
Yeah. So this concept of rather than doing blood draws through a venipuncture, so sticking a needle in an athlete's arm, obviously very invasive and athletes don't love it. So in 2017, we started investigating, you know, what are some alternatives to this? And one of the things that came about was, you know, they've been doing finger sticks and heel sticks on babies and in other instances, applications for decades. But there's a couple of companies in the U.S. that have actually developed new collection devices that basically just you put them on your arm and you stick them down, similar to like a sticky a 3M post-it note, and then you press a button and it draws blood out of the top layer of your skin, out of your capillaries. So we started working on this, and you know, ultimately it's culminated in there's two main ways to do it. So you can do finger sticks and you can do cards, or you can use these devices, which are essentially a biomedical device that it's all integrated into one. So you press the button, the blood gets drawn into a cartridge, and that cartridge has the spots in it, and then you send it off to the laboratory.
Fascinating. Yeah. Did the athletes like that you're initially piloting that out on just go, come on, this can't work? Like, did you get a lot of skepticism from them?
I think we got actually a lot of excitement because they don't want to get poked anymore. And you know, there's obviously a lot of scientific validation work to do. The blood that we collect now, because of the volumes, it gives you the most flexibility to do the analyses that we're looking to do. With a smaller volume of blood, then you're essentially limited by that. So really, you know, a lot of the work has been one, coming up with new collection procedures and instructing our sample collection personnel. And this is something great because you don't actually need a trained phlebotomist out in the field anymore. You can just have a doping control officer instruct the athlete on how to operate the device. And then, of course, the transportation costs around blood are huge for us. And so if it's dried, it's very stable. You can just throw it in the courier or the mail and it gets sent to the lab. And then, you know, you've got some limitations on the analysis side that you need to make sure that you work through, and you're limited in the number of things you can actually test for in a single spot. But I think it's going to, you know, continue to evolve, and we're actually looking at other complementary techniques. Like, rather than a dried blood spot cartridge, you can actually get like a micro volume, a tube of whole blood, and then doing things like the athlete biological passport analysis or some of the other analyses that we can just, instead of having to ship a huge tube to the lab, we can ship a micro tube is really advantageous.
Yeah, we used to do lactate samples like that way back in the day. Same type of concept. Okay, thank you for satiating. That's not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to get down to brass tacks.
I love talking about science.
No, that's cool. Like I said, when I initially saw it, I was like, wow, that's going to revolutionize things if the testing side of it can come around, right? If you can get a high enough quality test, precise enough test,
absolutely,
and test for the right things, it's going to be revolutionary.
Yeah.
You're the chief science officer.
Yes.
That's your official title, right?
Yes.
Okay. We're going to back up a little bit, and we're going to go into the science a little bit later, but I first want to go over all of the different like anti-doping tools that USADA uses at their disposal, because a lot of times we get geeked out on the stuff's like, oh, we're going to, you know, do a urine test, we're going to do a blood test.
Yeah.
And in many unfortunate ways, USADA kind of gets put into this box, and other anti-doping efforts kind of get put into this box of, well, we're just making people piss in a cup, and if the piss turns hot, which is the colloquial way that everybody describes it, right? If the piss turns hot, then, you know, the athlete's been doing something wrong.
Yeah.
But in reality, there's this, like, whole portfolio of things that you guys do. Without taking up the whole hour, can we just kind of, like, run through that just to set the table before we go into the science side?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we in the year 2000, when we were founded, I think lots of people thought, you know, we're just glorified pee collectors. We've come a long way in 20 years, not only on the science, but the reputation and what the organization's known for. So I think you can break it down into kind of four main areas. The first is education. So any successful program, we are looking to make sure we properly educate all of our stakeholders on what the rules are, how we go about the program. And that plays into deterrence as well, right? Because we're not all about just catching athletes out. It's really important that an effective anti-doping program, the number one goal should be to deter athletes from doping in the first place. So we have a lot of tools in our toolbox to try to achieve as high a level of deterrence as possible. So education is one component. You know, investigation and intelligence gathering is another. Testing is another component of that. New sample collection matrices is another. So that's always in the back of our minds, is that we're not just out to, you know, get a positive test. We are out to deter athletes from doping in the first place. And that should be the goal of any program. And I think it's also important to realize that whereas many people think of doping as a positive test, that's only one definition of doping. There's actually 12 different anti-doping rule violations that we're responsible for under our set of rules. So everything from sample manipulation to tampering to refusal of a test to aiding and abetting in doping if you're an athlete support personnel. So it gets very complicated very quickly. And people, I think they tend to like have this lens of, okay, we're just trying to collect urine here and get and detect some kind of a steroid in it. That's actually a really small part of what we do.
Yeah. Thank you for that background, because I do think, and I've talked to people in the community, especially the ones that haven't either had to participate in an athlete whereabouts program or anything like that. They just have this like really, really narrow lens. And I think broadening it out is super important.
Yeah.
So when we describe what USADA does, for our purposes, we're primarily going to use framework that you use for USA Track and Field, USA Cycling, and USA Triathlon, which are kind of the equivalent endurance applications. And before we go too far, I just want the listeners to understand that nobody's proposing that is the structure that gets implemented into ultra running. There's no governing body, and that's part of the issue that we're working with. If an athlete that, you know, qualifies for the national championships in track and field or whatever, they have this rule system incorporated into their lives by default. Mm-hmm. They have no choice in the matter.
Yeah.
But we're going to use that as framework because it's the current framework that exists.
Yeah.
So let's get into your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
We're going to go back to the prototype now, right, to explain it to listeners. an athlete is underneath some umbrella, USA Triathlon's umbrella, USA Track and Field's umbrella, USA Cycling's umbrella, and they have to submit a test.
Yeah.
Whether it's a race day test or somebody knocks on their door at 6 a.m. or whatever. Mm-hmm. What happens once that happens?
Okay. So do you want to talk about first kind of like the context of the rules, or do you want to get down to just like the testing part of it? You
start the context of the rules. Okay. If you think that provides good background.
I mean, just from the context of the rules that USADA and the United States in particular is a signatory to a doping against sport convention, a United Nations convention, and that makes us what's called a World Anti-Doping Code signatory. So the United States is a signatory to the convention, and then the World Anti-Doping Agency is the regulatory body that actually creates the set of rules in partnership with all their stakeholders. So right now, globally, there's over 700 code signatories, and that could be national anti-doping organizations like USADA. It could be national sport federations. It could be international sport federations. It could be the IOC. So all those people agree that we needed a harmonized anti-doping system globally, because an athlete in Italy or the UK or the US should be subject to the same set of rules. And before that existed, you had this totally chaotic system where essentially countries were responsible for administering their own anti-doping, and actually sports were responsible individually. So what did that encourage? A system that covered up tests, that was not independent. And that's, you know, by and large, the last two decades have been spent putting in this very extensive framework that protects athletes, but it also protects the independence of the anti-doping system and encourages harmonization. We're not there yet. You've got agencies like USADA in the world, and then you've got, you know, countries that maybe don't have the funding to fund anti-doping like they should. So there's still a lot of work to be done. But that's essentially the framework that's created that we operate under. And we could talk about professional sport as being like slightly different than that, but essentially professional sport has in a lot of instances collectively bargained agreements. So they use the World Anti-Doping System as kind of a guide, but then they modify it based on their sport.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm glad we went down that part, because before all of this existed, it was a really weird time where, you know, the Brazilian national tennis team would say, okay, well, we're going to test for these things in this way and on this frequency.
Yep.
And then you had like US tennis saying, okay, we're going to do something completely different.
Right.
And I remember when you would look at those different policies, it was like one was on Mars and one was on Venus, right? And the incentive structure was completely ass backwards.
And you need really, the core of the global framework is specific documents that govern and make standards around certain things. So we've got a standardized prohibited list. Everybody's agreed to the substances and the methods that are banned. You've got a standard for laboratories. So there's 30 accredited labs around the world that no matter where your sample goes, it should be analyzed in the same way. You've got an international standard for therapeutic use exemptions. So an athlete in the US that has a medical condition can get a prescription and get it evaluated in the same way as an athlete in another country. You've got a results management standard. So when there is a positive test or a violation, it's managed similarly in all countries. And so all these things, they just help to make sure that there's not inequity in the system. And I think, you know, when you're looking at a sport like ultra running, I think you need to look at it like that lens. And do you need to reinvent a system, or do you use the system that's in place? And can we improve the system? Absolutely. And we advocate for that every day. But we've got now a very robust system in order to operate under, which is really valuable for athletes.
I promise the listeners, we're going to come back to talking about TUEs, because that's a really hot topic, as well as results management or adverse findings management and how that whole process works. Yeah. But for the uninformed, let's go back to the original question, right?
Sure.
I'm sitting at my home, 6 a.m., DCO knocks on my door. You know, Mr. Cooper, you hear, I don't know why they'd be looking for me. That's the last person they'd be looking for. But somebody knocks on my door. We're here to drug test you.
Yeah.
athlete submits a sample.
Yeah.
What happens from there? Take us through the scientific process of what gets done to that sample or with that sample.
Sure. So when an athlete is notified at home, that's what's called an out-of-competition test. So they don't know the tester is going to show up. And that's a really important part of the work we do. If you gave advance notice, there would be ways that an athlete could maybe circumvent the test or not answer their door or those kinds of things. So
my doorbell doesn't work. We've all heard that one.
So once the athlete is notified, then the DCO instructs the athlete to go through this process. And the process involves sample collection equipment that allows the athlete to essentially provide a sample, and that sample gets split into an A and a B bottle. And that's really important because through the analysis process, and if there is a positive test, then that B bottle becomes really important to validate the finding in the A sample. And that's the athlete's right to have their B sample analyzed as part of the process. So they go through this process. It typically takes athletes, 15 minutes to 30 minutes to provide a sample if they're ready to provide a sample. They're responsible for securing their own equipment. They can see the equipment is secured. They package it up, and then the DCO sends it directly to the laboratory. And that equipment doesn't have any markings of the athlete's name on it. All that's on the bottle is a sample code number. And that's very important because the laboratories operate independently from USADA. So when they see the sample, they don't know whose sample it is. They know that it's a male or a female sample. They may know the sport that it comes from, but in order to have independence and make sure that a laboratory can't manipulate or lose a sample, then that code number protects the athlete. So once it arrives at the laboratory, then that's when all the kind of magic starts happening.
Okay. How does the lab know what they are testing for?
Yeah.
Because you can test for anything and everything,
sure,
and the cost goes up depending upon what you're actually testing for. In the situation where we're looking at USA Cycling, USA Triathlon endurance applications, right?
Yeah.
Is there a standard set of things that initially get run, or does the lab know we're matching up XYZ test with athlete number 12345?
Yeah, no. So it gets a little complicated, but basically there's three areas of the prohibited list. There's substances that are prohibited at all times. There's substances that are prohibited only in competition. And then there's substances that are prohibited only in particular sports. So when the lab gets the sample, they get the sample and it says in competition test or out of competition test. If it says out of competition, they're analyzing that sample for the menu of substances
Everything.
That is prohibited at all times.
Everything.
Yeah. So you've got anabolic steroids, you've got peptide hormones, you've got hormone and metabolic modulators, you've got diuretics. And so those substances are the core of what they analyze for as an out-of-competition test. Where it gets a little more complicated is that core menu can't analyze for some of the more sophisticated substances. So this is where, when you mentioned, the cost goes up, we have other ways to determine when we need to conduct what are known as special analyses. So there's a different menus that we can use. So analyzing for growth hormone releasing factors, analyzing for EPO, analyzing for testosterone. Those are extra tests, but we have other tools in our toolbox to be able to look at that sample and say, well, should it be analyzed for those things? What are the characteristics of that sample that may suggest an athlete is using those substances? And that's where the passport comes into play, because that informs us of when we need to spend extra money to order those tests.
So is it fair to say that when you're deploying one of the more advanced tests after you've done the first menu, it's a human looking at the whole situation. They're looking at, do we need to test for these things? They're looking at what I'm trying to say is how does that decision making process actually run?
Yep.
Like you've got the sample in, it's not hot. What's the opposite of piss turning hot? Is there
negative? We just call it negative.
We'll use the scientific words. So I'm here with scientists. Tests are all negative.
Yeah.
Who then looks at it and says, okay, you know what? Something's got to be going on here.
Yeah.
Let's run A, B, and C. How does that work?
Yeah. So it's let's just use an example like EPO. So EPO is a substance obviously used by athletes as a blood booster. It's a hormone that appears in our bodies naturally, produced by our kidneys. And so we need to be able to figure out whether the EPO that we see in the sample is supposed to be there or if it's synthetic EPO. So the way we do that is a number of different ways. The highest level way is that we're required to do a sport-specific risk assessment on a substance-by-substance basis. So if you're an endurance athlete, you would naturally have a higher risk because there's a history of EPO doping in your sport. So we assign a higher percentage of EPO tests to endurance-based sport samples than we would to, say, badminton samples. So that's the first level. The second level is using the athlete biological passport. So we collect blood samples on endurance athletes. We follow those indirect markers over time. And by looking at those indirect markers in conjunction at specific points in time, we can determine whether we need to assign EPO testing to specific samples based on the variability that we see in individuals. So that's an easy way for us to use our resources as effectively as possible, because we can say, okay, that athlete has an abnormal hemoglobin increase or abnormal immature red blood cell increase. Let's look a little more closely at that urine sample to see if the cause of that was EPO use.
And that's still blinded, right?
Absolutely.
Like it's somebody looking at athlete number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm looking at Jason Koops.
It's ABP. Blinded by the it's blinded to the laboratory. It's not blinded to us.
Okay.
So we know we collected the sample. We know what the results are, and we as USADA have our athletes in our registered testing pool that we can see their passport data and find out, okay, that sample is maybe a little anomalous. Let's look at that a little more. But we don't tell the athlete who that is. We just say, lab, analyze this sample for EPO.
Okay, so the lab has independence in terms of they don't know who they're testing.
Correct.
But USADA can pull these more stringent tools.
Yep.
Knowing who the individual is.
Yes.
I think that's an important distinction. Once again, not to say that this is what we deploy in ultra running, because that's probably solution like 5.0, like 10 years from now, maybe 20 years from now, we get to things like that. But I've always found that an interesting concept, that there's a human element looking at the ABP and I'll just say the landscape, because I know there's a lot of other things that go into it, and say, okay, we need to do this with that particular athlete, not just with the sample as a
absolutely
whole.
And so the other thing that adds another level of independence is when the hematology expert is looking at that ABP or that passport pattern, that person is not identified. So I may, as a chief science officer, be able to identify that athlete, but our expert looking at that particular result in the context of that passport's identified by basically an ID number that's anonymous. So they don't know who they're looking at. And that adds like another level of, okay, I can't bias my scientific opinion because I just happen to know who that is.
Right.
So we act on their recommendation and then notify the laboratory based on that.
Excellent.
So,
okay, good. I appreciate that context. Okay. Hot water.
Yeah.
TUEs.
Yeah.
I know you deal with this a lot.
Sure.
And you deal with it from both sides.
Yep.
And there's definitely both sides of this in ultra running, where we've got the camp that if you need a TUE, you shouldn't be able to compete in the sport,
sure,
or you shouldn't need to use that TUE in the sport. That's just inherent. If you're trying to be an elite athlete, you know, sorry, it causes too many problems.
Yeah.
And then you have what I would consider the more reasonable solution. We need to allow for TUEs in certain cases. Mm-hmm. I know you understand the criticism that it's an abused system.
Yeah.
But to start out with, why do we need TUEs in the first place? Why does sport need a place? Why do we need to carve out these things and say athletes should be able to take these under certain circumstances?
Yeah. So, great question. So, I mean, I think the most basic answer is that the prohibited list is a very diverse set of substances. And some of those categories of substances are used in medicine to treat common medical conditions that athletes may have.
Give an example.
They may be chronic conditions, or they may be like acute conditions, like musculoskeletal conditions. But an athlete may need, you know, for example, a good one is like an ADHD medication.
Right.
Okay, so they've been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. They're using a stimulant in order to operate their normal lives so they can operate day to day. We don't want to put their health in jeopardy by saying you need to wean yourself off that medication before you compete. So let's have a process in place that we have independent doctors that don't know the identity of that athlete looking at their medical records and evaluating it against the international standard of criteria that are specific to each substance and diagnosis, saying, was this condition diagnosed properly? Does it meet the ISTUE? And if so, we're going to grant this athlete a TUE to use this substance to protect their health. But more importantly, it has to return the athlete to a normal state of health. It can't return them to a supraphysiological state of health. So all those checks and balances are part of that process. And we have a TUE committee of 21 physicians that are medical specialists in each category that they may be looking at, saying, listen, we've looked at this diagnosis. More than one of us has looked at this diagnosis, and we agree that a TUE is necessary in this situation.
So how does the criticism get formed that it's so rife with abuse?
I'm not sure, to be
honest.
I know
this is a kind of an unfair question to this science officer, but you see
it,
right?
A little bit, you know, I'm responsible for the drug reference department, and we get about 800 TUE applications per year. And we evaluate all those in the same fashion. They all get evaluated independently. They go to physicians that are, you know, specialists in those fields, and they're evaluated according to the ISTUE. So there isn't some special, you know, criteria for one set of athletes versus another. They're all treated in the same fashion. So I think a little bit around the abuse may be not necessarily understanding the robustness of the process. Yeah. And just seeing that an athlete, you know, has a TUE, this one has a TUE, this one doesn't. And, you know, because they have a TUE, they must have got it just because they submitted a prescription and that's all they need. Yeah. That couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, this is part of the issue with races. Races that have drug testing policies that have this vague line or rule about TUEs where they're going to figure it out after the fact.
Right.
And I look at that, and there are races in ultra running that have this, but there are races outside of ultra running that I've seen that have this as well. I look at that and I'm like, you don't have the expertise to figure that out.
Right.
It's hard to figure it out with all of the experts in the room, just as you were alluding to. So you're going to tell me like your non-expert board of directors of this 501(c) is going to figure out if this TUE that somebody just got flagged for is actually really necessary. Like, I just look at that as bizarro town.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, I think it's important to have the right people looking at it, doing it in independent fashion, and then rendering a decision that is consistent across race to race, athlete to athlete, sport to sport. And at the end of the day, that takes the responsibility and the reaction out of the hands of race directors or individuals that don't have that expertise. And you don't want that liability either, to be honest.
Yeah. Trust me. We're going to move on from there, because otherwise I'll go down a rabbit hole and I'll take up all your time. Okay. Next thing that I promised we would talk about is what happens after an adverse finding.
Yeah.
So somebody comes and knocks on, we're going to use me as an example because I'll throw myself under the bus.
Sure.
Somebody comes and knocks on my door. I provide a sample and something shows up in it that the lab determined was not right. Some sort of out of competition, in competition, whatever it is. What happens at that point in time?
Yeah, so after an adverse finding, we get the result from the laboratory. That result is then matched up with an athlete's name. And
so lab still doesn't know who it is.
Lab doesn't know who it is.
This just showed up. They say athlete 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 has this.
They shoot the result to us. Yeah, exactly. And so the science department first reviews the laboratory testing data to make sure that, you know, everything has been done properly and that we agree that there's a positive. And then at that point, we would sometimes we actually do a little bit of an internal investigation, first of all. And what that means is we may collect another sample from the athlete before notifying them in order to see if the same pattern appears, or, you know, just to get a bit more information. Because a single sample is just a snapshot in time. And with many of these substances, we want to make absolutely sure that, you know, maybe there's another explanation, or we don't want to necessarily tip the athlete off first before we maybe gather some more information scientifically. So we may, the most common thing is to conduct a follow-up test. But it, once that process has been completed, essentially the athlete is notified of their adverse analytical finding or positive test, and they have the option of having their B sample analyzed. So that at that point, the athlete says, okay, I know what it is. It's my right to have USADA ask the laboratory. And the athlete can actually go to the laboratory and confirm the B sample is still closed and intact, confirm the sample code number matches, and they can actually themselves or a representative watch the analysis of that B sample to confirm the A sample result.
How many athletes actually do that?
Not very
many. Because I've always seen
a lot of athletes have their B sample analyzed, but very few. It's more common to either appoint a representative or just have the laboratory appoint a representative themselves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Up until that point, everything's internal.
Yeah.
Lab is blinded to who the athlete is, notifies USADA.
Yeah.
You guys unmask who the athlete is. You do a little bit of internal investigation. You then inform the athlete of the adverse finding.
Yes.
Is all the communication up until that point still in the room? Like, it hasn't been leaked out to the public.
Yes.
The only people that would know would be USADA and the athlete.
Yeah. And we never, throughout the whole process, it's important to know that USADA, the process is confidential. So at no point do we announce that an athlete is tested positive until we actually announce the sanction at the very end of the process. And that's really important because the athlete has rights during the process and they have the right to challenge the result as well. And that challenge, in fact, is confidential as well. So they have the right to an arbitration hearing. They have the right to representation. They can argue their case, and we don't publicize that, or that is all confidential until the point at which there is a conclusion. And that conclusion may be that that athlete is not charged, so then there's no announcement, or they're charged with an anti-doping rule violation and a sanction, and then there's a sanction announcement. And those are the things you see, you know, every so often coming
out.
The press releases.
Okay. How many times is there an actual false positive?
I don't like the word false positive because in our business, false positives are very serious. And the international standard for laboratories actually has, as part of its core framework, a internal quality assessment scheme that basically ensures that the laboratories operate under this standard, and they're sent samples in order to show that they're proficient at detecting these substances. So if either a proficiency testing sample is reported in the wrong way, the laboratory actually gets penalized for that. And you can have a laboratory, you've seen labs around the world either get suspended or they can get their laboratory accreditation revoked. And that's a serious thing for a laboratory. You never want to be reporting a false positive.
Right. Well, the reason I posed it that way is that in the scientific community, everybody realizes what a false positive is. You run a sample through however you're running it, and it shows something is being red, and it really is green. You're literally detecting something that's not there. That's the scientific version, or that's a scientific way to describe a false positive. But when a lot of people say that, what they really mean is something showed up that they didn't intend to show up.
Yeah.
They took a contaminated supplement.
Sure.
They didn't know that whatever XYZ was banned and things like that. I know that everybody in the anti-doping community is pulling their hair out over supplements.
Yeah.
Can you paint the picture of how big an issue that is?
Yeah, so it's a great topic and one that has been at our forefront for a number of years, and it's the issue of contamination.
Right.
And it's not just supplement contamination, it's pharmaceutical contamination, it's environmental contamination, it's contamination due to intimate contact with somebody that may be using a prohibited substance. So as we get better scientifically at detecting these substances, what the challenge is that you want to increase the detection window of these substances to get better at detecting the compounds. But what that also does is it leaves open the opportunity for detection of the presence of these compounds due to things that aren't intentional doping. And I think that's where the evolution in the thinking around anti-doping really is changing quite rapidly in the last couple of years. And USADA has been advocating for rule changes that make sure that this process remains fair around those things. So you don't want an athlete testing positive because they're using a permitted medication that just happens to contain a low-level diuretic that is there because of the manufacturing process, but the athlete did nothing wrong. We've had 10 of those cases. We've had cases around meat contamination, athletes testing positive because they had a dinner somewhere and there's residues of legal growth promoters in the meat that show up in their sample. So scientifically, we've actually been developing new solutions in order to solve some of these problems. And basically what the solutions are is minimum reporting limits for the laboratory for certain substances. So for example, for diuretics, even though it's prohibited at all times and the labs have methods that are extremely sensitive, they're not going to report when the concentration of those diuretics is at such a low level that there's a question that it could have come from contamination.
I promise that I won't ask you to define a picogram because I know some of the cases that you're referring to. Yeah. But I mean, is that a case where the technology and the scientific technique to detect these substances are moving faster than the policy?
I think in some instances, like, we want to make sure that, yeah, the science and the policy is connected and informing each other, right? And it's no fault of the laboratories. They're trying to do their best right. at detecting substances. The challenge then becomes, we don't want to be sanctioning athletes for unintentional doping and ruining their careers because we know the impact it has when we see an announcement of a positive test. So that's where we want to continually evaluate all the characteristics of these cases. And we've gone so far as to, you know, when we see a low-level diuretic, we ask the athlete to provide their medication. We go to the same pharmacy and get another prescription of that same medication, send it off to the laboratory and have it analyzed. And we found those diuretics in that prescription medication. So it's scientifically, it's a process to do that. But as you see more cases, you realize that there's a prevalence of this that you weren't aware of before. And so you need to adjust policy based on that to keep confidence in the system.
Because the detection levels are going down so quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what happens when athlete knocks on my door, I provide a sample, you get a really low level diuretic. Yep. I say, it's because, you know, I'm taking this heart medication. You guys go to the pharmacy, you get this heart. I'm not on heart medication. I'm just trying to come up with an example. You go and you get the heart medication and voila, like it's in there. What happens at that point? Does anybody know about that? Does that just stay in the room?
It's basically, it's between the athlete and USADA athletes. A lot of athletes at that point get assistance from some legal counsel to help them through the process. There's also an athlete ombudsman at the USOPC that can independently offer advice to athletes and help
if they're
guide
underneath
them.
One of the NGBs.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So that's a really useful resource for athletes that, okay, USADA is telling me this, but can you kind of, you know, help me verify it and figure it out. So, at that point, we work together with the athlete and, you know, it's the athlete's burden to demonstrate how the substance got into their bodies. But based on the science and what we've seen, it's, you know, part of my job to say, listen, does this make sense? Like, what's going on here? Let's try to like work with the athlete to find the source of their positive test.
Right. So it's not piss turns hot. Let's go sanction the athlete.
Absolutely not.
Whatever the scientific version, we have an adverse finding. Yeah. Let's figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
during the part of figuring out what's going on, there's all these different pathways that you can take. The yeah. athlete can have their B sample tested. They can be present when it's tested. You ask them for a list of all these other things that they've been taking. You can go to the pharmacies and piece the story together before determining what to do. I mean, from what you're describing, it's a very methodical, planned process. And at the end of it, it's either, you ran afoul of the rules, or no, you didn't. This was unintentional.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, through that process, we there's a point at which if, you know, we don't hear from the athlete, or it's an egregious substance and the athlete, you know, doesn't provide any kind of explanation, you know, we'll charge the athlete with an anti-doping rule violation. At that point,
they're not being compliant.
Essentially. You know, they've got a violation, they've got a positive test. And at that point, we will offer a sanction to the athlete. So they can either agree to that sanction or they can challenge that sanction. So, you know, they can challenge it. They can go to arbitration. They can offer an alternative explanation. And that is all done with a panel of independent arbitrators from the American Arbitration Association. And then if they don't like the result of that arbitration, so those arbitrators will render a decision like, yes, this violation is valid. We're going to sanction you for X amount of time. They have an appeal right as well. And at that point, you can take your case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And that is the international sport body that hears appeal cases for anti-doping. So they're based in Switzerland. And, you know, that's the final body that can make a ruling. And many cases are re-adjudicated at that level. So you have to start from scratch again and present your case. And USADA presents its case, and then the arbitrators make a decision. So it's a multi-stage process depending on, you know, what the situation is.
And under the umbrella of the three NGBs that we're kind of using as a model, who pays for the legal bills?
That's a little complicated. So many times the athlete pays for their legal bills and USADA pays for its legal bills. There is certain circumstances where legal aid might be available to the athlete depending on their situation. And then at the end of the day, the arbitrators can decide, you know, maybe depending on the outcome of the case, the athlete is responsible for a portion of USADA's legal bill, or USADA is responsible for a portion of the athlete's legal bill. So depending on the circumstances, I mean, it is different in every case.
Somebody's got to pay the legal bill, though. I mean, I think that's a realistic ramification of having this type of rule structure. When you elevate the case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, you got to be able to figure that out. That might be getting too far ahead for our group. So let's kind of go back to something a little bit more fundamental that you already touched on, and this is this area of sanctions, right? There are levels of sanctions, and they range from really benign, like what we would call a slap on the wrist colloquially, right, to a lifetime ban for sport. You cannot go back to the sport for forever. Why fundamentally is there this big range? Let's start with that, and then we can kind of take it into the buckets that we typically see in the media play out.
So a little bit of history. When the World Anti-Doping Code, the first version of it, came out, the default sanction was 2 years.
Doesn't matter. Everybody gets 2 years.
Well, no. So there's 2 years is the default sanction. And then based on mitigating circumstances and degree of fault, you can go from 2 years, and that sanction can either go up or down depending on the circumstances of the case. So for example, on the prohibited list, there's substances that are specified substances and non-specified substances. Non-specified substances are like anabolic steroids. So if you test positive for an anabolic steroid, your default sanction is 4 years. If you can show that there's some reason to reduce your degree of fault, that 4 years can go down to as low as 1 year. But for specified substances like stimulants, for example, they're less egregious. You could get a public warning depending on the circumstances of your case. So the rules, the sanctions are scalable depending on, you know, various mitigating factors that come to play in the case itself.
But The fundamental, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I'm going to kind of ask the question again. The fundamental reason why there are different level, what, I guess I won't put words in your mouth. What is the fundamental reason why there are different levels of sanctions? Is it because of the egregiousness of the offense or this one calibration point? Because I want people to understand that just like in any other sporting event, you have degrees of penalty. You go watch a football game, you have a 5-yard penalty, a 10-yard penalty, a personal foul, people get ejected from the game. You don't eject everybody from the game for a holding penalty.
Yeah.
What is the philosophical umbrella that the different rules fit under? Is it the egregiousness of the offense? Is it the potential to enhance performance? Is it the harm to the sport? Like, how does that all get worked out?
It gets a little complicated, but essentially you've got athletes demanding that that 4 years for an egregious offense takes an athlete out of sport for long enough that it acts as an effective deterrent for doping, right? So if you only slap somebody on the wrist and say they can't compete for 30 days, that's not very effective at deterring somebody from using a doping substance. So the reason the 4 years exists for egregious doping is that that removes those athletes from competing and participating in sport for an amount of time that's been agreed to by the 700 signatories that are out there. So that's changed over the years. It used to be 2, now it's 4.
So it's part deterrent, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Absolutely.
The philosophy behind this 4-year benchmark, it has a lot to do on the deterrent side of it.
But as we discussed, there's lots of reasons why a substance may be in an athlete's sample. So you want to be able to adjust the sanction based on that so that you're not giving somebody who ingested a substance because they didn't intend to 4 years. That seems very, very unfair, right? So it's not just apples to apples to apples. Every case is different, and therefore the legal system allows for this adjustment process based on the situation. And you've got case law informing that. So USADA, when we propose a sanction, we may look at past cases for that substance or similar circumstances and say, well, in this situation, 1 year seems appropriate, but in this situation, you know, we can't go below 2 years.
And who is at the table figuring that out?
The legal team.
You're like, not me, I'm out of that decision. I could just tell you green or red.
Well, and it's important, like, it's not just USADA making that decision. We make it in the context of cases that are adjudicated worldwide. So the sport itself has an appeal right, and WADA also has an appeal right. So if they don't agree with our sanction length, they can appeal that to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So it prevents USADA from saying, okay, we're going to give all U.S. athletes a really lenient sanction when all these other countries are penalizing their athletes more heavily. Like, there's checks and balances in the system to prevent countries and anti-doping organizations from being wildly different with sanctioning of athletes under the rules.
So I'm going to represent the people that are listening right now that are giving this a hard eye roll. And the hard eye rollers are the people that are going, well, these people that get popped for EPO in the endurance world, right, that's a heavy hitting drug.
Yeah.
They need to be sanctioned for more than 4 years because that drug has an effect on their performance outside of that 4 years. And I would actually put myself in that opinion category as a coach. I know that training that I apply to an athlete lasts for more than 4 years if I'm doing my job right.
Sure.
But in addition to that, the scenario that they have in their head is an athlete gets popped for something heavy hitting like EPO. They go into the arbitration that you just mentioned.
Yep.
They present some compelling reason. My meat was contaminated and I was taking this, you know, over the counter, this, that, or the other, my supplements or whatever. And they get their sanction reduced, not raised.
Yeah.
Like, I want listeners to understand, like, peel the curtain back a little bit on how USADA either sticks to, we're going to levy out this 4-year sanction or reduce it.
Yeah. Well, that's where, you know, by and large, the legal process and arguments come into play, right? So when we're saying, okay, we think the athlete should get a 4-year sanction, and the athlete challenges that, they may have their reasons for challenging it. We have our reasons. We have science that suggests that they got this performance benefit. It's an egregious substance, you know, a whole host of explanations. And then it's up to the arbitrators to say, okay, who had the better argument and who are we going to believe? You know, it's not a beyond a reasonable doubt. It's to a comfortable satisfaction. That's the legal framework that we operate under. So, you know, it by and large, if an athlete is not able to argue effectively that this substance, you know, appeared for a non-doping reason, they're going to get the full sanction.
Where does the benefit of the doubt lie in those?
What do you mean?
I mean, the athlete is always going to say they're going to come up with some reason. And we see this play out in the media all the time. There's all these, you know, I can say it. I know you probably can't, but there are all these bullshit reasons mm-hmm. why athletes have tested positive for something. And they're going to come to the table with those reasons in a room with USADA, with the science officers and things like that. And inherently there's going to be a disagreement.
Yep.
Yes, I did this. No, you didn't.
Yeah.
When in deciding what ultimately happens, like in the legal system, there's a burden of proof, right? That lies on one side.
Yeah.
Where does that lie within this system? Does it lie on the athlete or does it rely on USADA proving that something happened?
Yeah. So great question. So when we have a positive test, it's the athlete's burden to demonstrate.
That's what I wanted you to get at.
But in other violations like use violations or a passport case, it's USADA's burden to demonstrate the athlete doped.
So it's different depending on the situation.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's my job. One of the things I love about my job is the legal department comes to me and says, the athlete gave us this excuse. Tell me scientifically if it's a valid excuse or not. And that's my job, is to write a scientific opinion, consult with outside experts, look at the research that's being done, maybe even do additional research out there to demonstrate whether what we're seeing lines up with the athlete's explanation or it's due to doping. And that's what I do every day.
What's the craziest reason you ever heard? I know you probably can't tell me, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. I want to know the most ridiculous off the wall thing you've ever heard.
You can stylize it if you want to. I think the most challenging cases recently in recent mind, and you know, I would have never believed this is the intimate contact cases that we've recently had. And it takes a lot of scientific evaluation and work to piece together, you know, the pharmacology, the pharmacokinetics, the how they ingested it, how they were exposed. Like all these cases, I mean, they're analyzed to the nth degree to try to determine whether it's possible. And some people would say it's not. I firmly believe, depending on the circumstances, that these were true contamination cases, and no athlete should be penalized for that. So those are some of the craziest. I mean, there's been, you know, it was in my toothpaste or, I rubbed up against somebody, or, you know, I think there was one excuse, like I ran by a hospital and EPO splashed on me from the street and, you know, just crazy stuff like that. But generally those are always,
I wanted to use that though as a little bit of an example that it's not like you're just taking the athlete's word for it.
Absolutely.
Right?
Not.
It's not just like, oh, well, you know, so and so Coop said that, you know, he had a contaminated Tic Tac or whatever. And, you know, okay, well, we believe him. Yeah. You're actually looking at the validity of the whole situation through a lot of different, very complicated mechanisms that we're not going to go into. Okay. Yeah. I appreciate that dialogue. Thank you for entertaining me. You could tell me the real story off there. Okay. Let's theorize for a little bit. You kind of know ultra running situation, right? It's a sport that doesn't fall underneath any sort of governing body, either nationally or international, with very, 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 very few exceptions. And the community as a whole is trying to figure this out. The athletes are trying to figure it out. I'm doing my part as a coach to try to figure it out. Race directors are trying to figure it out. Sponsors and brand managers are trying to figure it out.
Sure.
We're not going to get adopted by something and have a rule system all of a sudden placed over us. Yeah. We've got to kind of figure it out. What are the big, broad brushstrokes that you would advise the community to look at as we're trying to get our feet wet and just figure out a solution?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this goes back to, you know, one of your first, very first questions. I think there's four things you need to think about, you know, education, testing, science, and results management. And so in breaking those things down, I think, you know, you need a harmonized program. You can't have different rules for every single event or, you know, athlete. So having a harmonized set of rules and taking some cues from what's currently working, I think, is the first step. And then you need to educate athletes around that. You can't put rules in place and athletes don't know what rules they're subject to. So, you know, for example, in the UFC program, we didn't even start testing athletes for 6 months. We spent 6 months educating those fighters on what the rules were, because we knew that was important for them to understand. Once the program hit and we started testing, they were then responsible. So that's how I would outline how you would start. Then you've got to have a testing program in place that not only has in-competition testing, but has a robust out-of-competition testing program. So athletes, it's almost like an IQ test when you test them in comp. Like you're going to, you know they're going to be tested because they compete, so they can stop using whatever they're doing and they're using it during training. So those most highest level athletes in your sport, I would suggest, you know, an out-of-competition program on those athletes where they file whereabouts and they are subject to testing anytime, anywhere. And that is a huge deterrent to doping in the sport. And then, of course, you've got the science component and making sure that, you know, if the resources allow, that you're adopting things like the passport and you're doing some of the scientific things to increase the analyses of samples. So, you know, beyond just the basic analyses, having a framework in place to do EPO testing, to do testosterone testing, some of these things that are likely being used in the sport due to their risk. You know, you want to make sure that you're at least doing some testing of those in an intelligent fashion. And then the results management of that is, of course, you know, you don't want to put that in the hands of, you know, your governing body or your race organizers. You want to have an independent body like USADA governing that. And that protects the sport. It protects the athlete. And it makes the process consistent from, you know, athlete to athlete if they test positive.
Those are the bare minimum.
Yep.
Would you recommend, in your professional opinion, and you're the expert here, finding a solution that doesn't have one of those components? Or has a really shitty part of one of those components. And I'm trying to work down right to the practical piece of it. Yeah. So we can get together the education and the testing and the screening,
yeah,
but results management, we don't know what we're going to do with. Let's just throw the solution out there.
Yeah. Well, I think those are the basic components, because without any one of those, what you're going to open yourself up to is a lot of criticism, right? People are going to say, well, you're trying to do anti-doping, but you're missing a vital component of this, right, which is either unfair to athletes, or it's totally ineffective, or it's not financially, you know, viable, because you can't have a race director funding the results management of a case that, if an athlete wants to take it to the highest levels of, you know, adjudication, it might cost tens of thousands of dollars. I'm sure race organizers don't want to be, you know, on the hook for that, right, after the fact.
I'm going to evoke a quote from... I'm going to keep this person anonymous, because he probably wants to be anonymous in this conversation. But when we were originally talking about this kind of within USADA, he would tell me that you're better off having those four components and having a solution that meets the minimum part of those four,
yep,
than removing one entirely in a way to kind of get the program off the ground. Yep. Like you're going to be stuck with initially having imperfect solutions, but if those imperfect solutions hit all those categories, you have something to build off of. Yeah.
And hopefully I've given you like a flavor for, you know, on the surface, anti-doping may seem like just collecting a sample and analyzing it, but there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that, you know, it's vital in order to have a fair and consistent and a confident, you know, athletes confident in the process. If we had laboratories knowing whose samples they analyzed, you know, there's a hole there that could be exploited, right? So it's really, you know, that framework is so important.
We're going to leave it at that. First off, I really appreciate your time. This has been over a year in the making.
It's awesome that I've finally been able to talk to you.
Finally, I will have explained that backstory in the intro so everybody knows. But to leave the listeners, and this is particularly pointed at the athletes, if they want to get more educated on this whole suite of stuff, where can they go to, either in USADA's website or anywhere else to get that education?
Yeah, so we've got a comprehensive website that, you know, if you go to the athlete section, a lot of these aspects that we've talked about today are outlined, and athletes can find more about the collection process or results management, or look at our education. So I would encourage you to go directly there. And you know, World Athletics, as well as the international sport body, they do great work, as their anti-doping team there is awesome. So if athletes are interested to see what's going on internationally, that's another resource.
Yeah. Dr. Matt, this is great, man. Yeah. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate what you do within your organization, what your entire organization does for sports. I think I could speak for the sporting community, and I'm just greatly appreciative of it. And I was here. I moved to Colorado Springs in 2000. I saw the transition from NGB's running the show to USADA running the show. And I honestly think that despite all the criticism that gets thrown around every once in a while, that's one of the most impactful transitions in all of Olympic sport. That singular transition right there, and it has made such a big impact. It's always going to have bumps in the road, but seeing it from the ground level and what it did, how it like transformed cultures within sports, has been absolutely amazing. You're a big part of that, and we awesome. Thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks, Jason.
All right, folks, there you have it. There you go. Much thanks to Dr. Fedoric for coming on the podcast today. I appreciate everybody that made it through the intro. That was normally a long one. I usually like to get through those a little bit quicker, but I feel that the caveats are necessary, because otherwise, if I don't say anything, people are going to be like, why don't you say anything? And I just want to get it out on the table, because this information is super important. I do think that this aspect is super important for the community as a whole. So stick around. Next week, we've got Paul Demio. That's on June 3rd that will be released. The next week, we have Lisa Roberts, who got kind of entangled in this whole thing with Western States. That's on June 10th. And then June 17th, Charlie Ware, who is my hero, he actually decided to do something about this. God bless his soul. We go through that whole arc of what he tried to do and what the pitfalls are and how people in the community can pick up on his work, which is super important. That is coming out June 17th. And then finally, a great conversation with Dylan Bowman and Mari Frioli about what they think as community members, what they think anti-doping solutions should look like. So I hope everybody is looking forward to the next series of podcasts that I'm putting out. I really appreciate everybody who has come together for these. I did put these together kind of all in sequence, so they're going to be released while I'm out on the Pacific Crest Trail with Timothy Olson. And what I really wanted to mention with that is I hope the community uses this as a galvanizing point and creates some sort of conversation around these issues, because as I have mentioned, and as I will continue to mention over the course of the next several podcasts, is that it is going to be up to us. Nobody's going to save us but ourselves. And the initial part in all of this, before we start going down the rabbit hole of, do we want to ban people for life or let everybody dope up to the gills or whatever solution kind of emerges, before we go down that part of determining the finer bullet points of anti-doping solutions, let's first take pause, educate ourselves on all of the different complexities of this particular issue, of which there are many. Educate ourselves first, and then come together as a community and hammer out the solutions. Let's take some time and get some education underneath our belts. I hope that this podcast and the next several podcasts serve as an initial point for all of those educational pieces. That is it for the podcast today. Let me know what you think on social media. I'm sure it'll all fly around, but I hope you guys are looking forward to the next week and the week after that and the week after that. As always, we will see you out on the trails.